Till last year, the question was occasionally asked, what will make people rise up and take to the streets? Those of us who remember the 60s and 70s remember those years as times of frequent demonstrations in the streets, and the years afterward as, well, tamer. Our next guest has a long view of people taking it to the streets. L.A. Kaufman is the author of Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. L.A. Kaufman writes about radical movements as an insider, participant, and strategist, as well as observer and journalist. Among her credits, organizing large anti-war protests as the Iraq War was getting started. Her writing on radicalism and social movements has been published in the likes of The Nation and N Plus One and other publications. L.A. Kaufman, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeffrey.
So there's a bit of a history lesson here. I mean, was this something you had planned to write for a while, or did the crush of people heading for the streets after the election bring it about?
No, this book has been kind of ridiculously long in the making. I actually started it in 1991.
Wow.
So I worked on this for 25 years, and it is just an extraordinary coincidence that it is coming out at a moment when there has been such an upsurge of interest in what kind of protests are most effective, how people should organize most effectively.
You know, it's no surprise that you mentioned the 60s in the very first sentence of your introduction. It's what many of us remember, but, you know, we tend to remember the things in our own lives more than we're aware of what happened when we weren't around. Was that truly the peak of American radicalism, as best anyone can tell?
Well, you know, there's a strong case to be made that the 30s might get that credit. But I think, you know, so many people who came of age after the 60s, there's a way in which the myths of the 60s have loomed so large that certainly when I was coming of age in the 80s, it was almost paralyzing. It was like, well, you'll never match this level of, you know, creativity and rebellion that happened in the mythic 60s. And I've been very interested in trying to focus attention on the many very effective and productive movements that haven't quite been mythologized to the same degree, that haven't been studied as much, and whose accomplishments perhaps have been missed.
Was part of the boom in radicalism in the 60s brought about by the fact that there were so many boomers? I mean, when you think about the fact that the baby boomers were coming of age then, I mean, they were in their late 20s, the oldest of them by the mid-20s, by the time the late 60s rolled around. I just wonder how much the mass of people under a certain age led to that.
Yeah, there's no question that demographic surge was part of the broader cultural climate of, you know, iconoclasm and dissent in the period. But it was really the crises around civil rights and the Vietnam War that got people politicized and thinking deeply about what it would take to organize for justice in this country.
The book, again, is called Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. L.A. Kaufman, its author, our guest. So before we go too much further, we should probably pause to define radicalism. Are we talking only about the left here?
Well, I'm mostly talking about the left. I mean, I see some, you know, I look at some points when there are parallels on the right when they've used similar tactics of nonviolent resistance, which happens sometimes, but not that frequently. I when I use radicalism, that's a word that sometimes scares people away. But you know, to be radical means going down to the roots, and the movements that have brought progress, that have brought a lot of the gains that we now take for granted, have often been so far outside the mainstream consensus at the time that radical is the best description of them. I know for some people that means, you know, some like wild-eyed insurrectionary, but that's not really what I mean.
It's less wild-eyed and more just that it is that different from what the general mainstream thought is at the time.
Right, it's very far ahead of the time when people are, you know, radicals are often people who will look at deep systems and structures of power that are unquestioned by, you know, the mainstream society, and in their organizing try to shine a spotlight on injustices that have been invisible.
So another term to define, which you admit yourself in the book is a slippery one, direct action. So when we're talking about direct action, well, what do you mean, I guess? Let's start there.
Well, for me, the simplest way to define it is that it's all the forms of political participation that lie outside the standard established channels. So we know that, you know, you can vote and take part in elections. You can participate by showing up public hearings. You can call your legislator. You can lobby as a citizen. There are all these established ways to try to influence what happens in our government. But when those channels aren't working, or when injustice is so great and urgent, people have always turned to other forms of influence, whether it be street protests or sit-ins or rallies or blockades. And that whole array of kind of outsider tactics are what I mean by direct action.
All right. So not making use of the political system, which is by nature less direct than direct action.
Right, exactly. So it's trying to influence the political system, but it's doing so more from outside than from, you know, within the standard channels.
So when we come back to the 1960s and 70s, as you point out, I mean, a lot happened then, too. Did all the protesting ultimately fail? I mean, the electorate appears to have moved consistently to the right since those days.
Well, the electorate appears to have moved consistently to the right, but when you look at many of the issues that that the grassroots movements have been addressing throughout this period. I mean, obviously, where we are right now with the current administration, I'm bracketing that for the moment. But it, you know, if you look at, for example, the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender folks, there's been huge gains in the last decades. Women's rights, civil rights, the environment, all of the kinds of clusters of issues that grassroots movements have worked on, you can see a lot of gains, even as in strictly electoral terms, the country has moved to the right. And I credit those gains to the bold forms of organizing that movements have used to create pressure on decision makers, whatever their party affiliation, and to produce productive gains, even in times that are of conservatism and backlash.
So I find myself now thinking that perhaps the electorate has moved right, not in spite of a lot of work on the left, but perhaps because of. I mean, if the people doing direct action are working outside the political system and still getting their gains, they don't necessarily feel like they have to go to the polls, do they?
Well, I think one thing that's really interesting about this moment is that a lot of the resistance energy is being focused squarely at the electoral arena now in a way that we haven't typically seen. I mean, you're right that there is a way in which grassroots movements of the left perhaps ceded the electoral arena too much to what you might call like the Democratic Party mainstream corporate Democrats whose agendas are not the same as the base of the party. And I think right now you're seeing people working to respond to the threat of the Trump administration by engaging at every different level. Yes, there are lots of street protests happening right now. There are also lots of people considering running for office or getting involved in their local Democratic Party committees, or this weekend in Atlanta trying to change the direction of the Democratic National Committee. So there's a really interesting move now from the grassroots up to engage in the electoral arena in new and powerful ways.
L.A. Kaufman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Long experience with the radical movement as an insider, participant, and strategist, observer, and journalist. She's written a book called Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. We can take your calls and emails about radicalism then and now. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The book begins with the May Day protests of 1971, the Nixon administration in power at that time. What did those protests seek to do, and what was the response?
Extraordinary and almost forgotten event. In 1971, there was this incredible attempt to shut down federal government through nonviolent direct action. It was at the end of many years of organizing against the Vietnam War that seemed to not be having any impact. and people tried to do something new. Their slogan was, if the government won't stop the war, the people will stop the government, which was, of course, hyperbole. They weren't really going to stop the government if they managed to shut down the District of Columbia. But the vision of paralyzing the government nonviolently was so powerful and so unsettling to the Nixon administration that two things happened. One, they basically freaked out and brought in the military. They brought in, under Nixon's direct orders, they brought in the Marines, the National Guard, even regular Army troops in helicopters and assault vehicles, rounded up more than 7,000 people off the streets of Washington, D.C., in the largest mass arrests in U.S. history. It was an incredible militarized response to, you know, a bunch of hippies sitting down in the streets. And even more significantly, the protest was condemned at the time by pretty much everyone, and even the organizers said that they thought it had been a failure. But from a longer view, it was anything but. There's a lot of evidence that it was one of the things that really pressured the Nixon administration to hasten the withdrawal from Vietnam and marked a real turning point, a moment when the Nixon administration became so concerned at the specter that the American people would be ungovernable if the war continued that it decided to begin to withdraw.
So I guess you have to take a long view when assessing the results of any particular set of direct actions.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, people are always saying, you know, okay, the Women's March happened on January 21st. Well, what change do we see on January 22nd? You know, on January 22nd this year, what happened was Donald Trump issued the global gag rule, which was not at all what the marchers wanted. If your time frame is too small, you're not really, you know, protests don't, the cause and effect is not always immediately clear. The impact is not always immediately evident, and it's important to step back when considering these movements and what they accomplish. People will often judge the effectiveness of a protest at the time by its popularity or unpopularity. And when you look at a longer view, it's often the most unpopular movements that achieve the most.
Let's talk about the movements that are unpopular, at least the tactics that are unpopular. I mean, a direct action does scare some people. It certainly spooked the Nixon administration, obviously, in May of 1971. But even to today, I mean, people get scared when windows get smashed and other people get hurt. You indicate in the book there were lots of discussions about tactics among the likes of the Weathermen and SDS and other notable groups of the 60s and 70s. Was there ever a consensus reached about moves that help or hurt the cause?
Well, I think if you look at, you know, across the board at grassroots organizing over the last 30, 40 years, you'll find it's overwhelmingly nonviolent by the strictest definition of the term, which excludes the destruction of property. Certainly by the standard of nonviolence towards other people, there are almost no injury. There's almost no recorded injuries at protests that were caused by the protesters. The injuries are usually police attacking protesters when there are injuries reported at a demonstration. For decades, there have been, small, usually pretty small groups of people who've kind of gone outside the definition, the strictest definition of nonviolence, and done some modest amounts of property destruction. The attention is always disproportionate to the scale. I recognize that in Oregon, it's been perhaps more in the foreground than in some other parts of the country. On the whole, I would say there is a very broad consensus that nonviolence has been strategically the most effective choice in nearly all circumstances, particularly in moments when there's concern about rising police repression. I find it strategically valuable not to provide easy pretexts for the suppression of movements. And, you know, the smashing of one window can be the pretext for, you know, arresting hundreds of people who were just protesting peacefully in the streets. So I'm one who has always appreciated the strategic value of nonviolence, but it's, you know, the folks who are going to pursue other tactics are not really swayed by what other people think about it. There's not really any, you know, like, you know, publicly condemning it doesn't really change whether or not it happens.
We're talking to L.A. Kaufman on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of the book Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism, a conversation you are welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange, either with memories or thoughts about what's been going on recently. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. What effect do you think the ending of the draft, military draft, had on the radical movement?
Oh, good question about how much it added to it in the first place and how much it might have changed when the draft ended.
I mean, there's no question that people respond differently when their own personal lives and interests are at stake. So the end of the military draft made it much harder to mobilize mass resistance to America's, you know, unending military adventures. Because there wasn't the same sense of personal engagement from, you know, nearly every able-bodied young male in America. So it made a difference. Absolutely. I think that's part of why it was, why the draft was eliminated, because it removed a ready source of recruitment for anti-war forces.
Certainly that. We have an email here from John, no town given. He says, sorry, I missed the beginning of the interview. What evidence is there that nonviolent civil disobedience is more effective than violent revolution?
Well, I haven't seen, you know, I don't know where violent revolution is on the table. So, you know, it feels like certainly, you know, in the United States that that has not been on the table perhaps since the founding of the country in any realistic way. So I'm not sure what it means to argue against that hypothetical. As far as the evidence of the overall effectiveness of nonviolent resistance, I mean, I think you that history is filled with examples, whether it's the end to racial segregation or the advent of rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender folks. The response to the AIDS epidemic, where the nonviolent resistance of the group ACT UP literally saved millions of lives.
You single out ACT UP as the most innovative, influential, and effective radical organization of the late 20th century. That's high praise.
It's, and I mean every word of it. I think ACT UP, you know, not only was staggeringly effective in saving millions of lives and transforming many aspects of the ways in which medications for diseases are tested and approved and distributed, that they also offered a really powerful organizing model that that we all should look to. They were very bold. They were also very polarizing. That goes back to the point I was making earlier about that these things, that the most effective protests are not the most popular ones oftentimes. ACT UP was rude and obnoxious. They were people, many of them were very sick. They were in the process of dying. They were fighting for their lives and had no time to be polite to politicians who were ready to turn their backs and treat people with HIV as pariahs. And I think the combination of their boldness and persistence in occupying government offices, they did things like they threw the ashes of their loved ones onto the White House lawn. I mean, really strong tactics, combined with just really first-rate research into the issues. They educated themselves very thoroughly on the minutiae of drug testing protocols. And so once they were able to sit down, and once their protests gained them access to meetings with key officials in the FDA and other government agencies, they were able to come to the table with very, very specific proposals of how to change the testing protocols in order to speed up the approval of life-saving medications. And that combination of the insider and the outsider approach was just extraordinarily productive, and one that I think many movements can learn from.
There's a lot of history tracked in the book, as I mentioned, beginning with the May Day protests of 1971, ending up with the protests in Ferguson over the killing of Michael Brown. And I noticed that you got out to JFK right after the first Trump travel ban was put in place, L.A. What did you see there?
It was, I mean, that was quite a powerful day. I got out there pretty early on. There was text messages that went out from some of the immigrant rights groups in the New York area that have been working on these issues for a long, long time. And when we first arrived, you know, it was maybe, I don't know, 50, 75, 100 people. Nobody even had any signs because it was such a rush, you know, to get out to the airport, which is not very easy to do. So there were markers, and people were finding, you know, scraps of cardboard in the garbage and just kind of throwing together whatever they could. And the feeling of the growth of the crowd over the course of the next few hours, as more and more people came and, you know, dropped everything that day in order to stand in solidarity with the folks covered by the Muslim ban, it was just a beautiful coming together. By the time I left in the late afternoon, it was, you know, spilled over the sidewalks. It was just the crowd was taking over the parking garage. There were so many people there. And, you know, JFK is hard to get to in the best of circumstances.
Right. So you're primarily observer now, or still taking part in a lot of direct action?
Oh, I'm involved in a lot of anti-Trump projects right now. There's a lot of different initiatives underway, and I've been in the mix on them.
All right. The book is called Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. As L.A. Kaufman mentioned at the beginning, she'd intended to do this since 1991. Now it's here. L.A. Kaufman, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Jeffrey. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Take care.